From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, inside the EPA's National Summit on PFAS Water Contamination and the push for national standards.
Administrator Scott Pruitt announced that the process needs to begin, but the consensus was that it could take years, a decade or more, for that to even happen.
A Michigan mom turns to the mental health system seeking help for her son.
I said, you know, my son is going to hurt someone if he's not hospitalized right away.
And how that search failed them both, plus the truth behind a plea of guilty but mentally ill.
It misleads offenders, it misleads the public, it misleads courts, it misleads defense attorneys who believe that GBMI defendants are accorded some kind of special post-conviction treatment. They are not.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The EPA held a national PFAS summit in Washington Tuesday, diving into issues surrounding the per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, which have contaminated groundwater in sites across the country, including 31 known sites here in Michigan. It drew representatives from state governments, tribes, environmental groups, and federal agencies. MLive's Garrett Ellison has been covering PFAS contamination in Michigan, and he was in D.C. for yesterday's summit. He's with us now via Skype. Garrett, what was the stated purpose of the summit?
Well, the purpose was to bring together everybody across the country who's involved in the PFAS contamination in states like Michigan, I guess to get everybody in the same room and discuss some of the thorny issues related to the contamination, such as do we set national standards? Do we regulate PFAS chemical by chemical or as a class? What's going on with this ATSDR study that's supposed to come out, was apparently headed off at the pass by EPA and the Pentagon. So things like that.
Yeah, we are going to talk about that report in a moment. It's interesting now we can get a chance from through you to hear what other states are saying about their issues and their concerns with the sites that they have that are contaminated with PFAS. What'd you hear?
Well, there was a lot of desire to develop some sort of national standard for PFAS, not just for the two most well-known, PFOS and PFOA, but some sort of exposure through drinking water and cleanup standard in terms of cleaning up contaminated sites for the different PFAS chemicals. You know, some states were there in kind of a leadership role, I guess, as it was called. Michigan Department of Environmental Quality Director Heidi Grether gave a presentation. Other states were there in the audience and they were asking questions and they were saying, like, look, you know, we like this idea of EPA moving forward with a maximum contaminant level for PFAS, similar to the action level for lead in drinking water, but that's probably going to take years. So you guys haven't even been able to pass an MCL since the 90s. So we're just going to go ahead and do it on our own. Thanks very much.
So, yeah, we can't wait for you is basically what you heard.
That was a lot of it, yeah.
Now, we know Michigan with its 31 sites, as you just mentioned, DEQ Director Heidi Grether was there, also Michigan PFAS Action Response Team, MPART Chief Carol Isaacs. In fact, today, MPART put out a release calling on the EPA to please move ahead with more research, more rules regarding PFAS contamination. What about at the summit yesterday, as other states are calling for action and saying, hey, we're going to do our own standards? What did these Michigan officials say?
Well, Michigan wants to see national standards, partly because they're having issues in Oscoda with Wurtsmith Air Force Base. There is a dispute going on right now between the DEQ and the Air Force related to the adequacy of cleanup in the Oscoda area around that former base where they used to fly nuclear bombs out of. So essentially, there's some push and pull going on between the state and the federal government related to getting the Air Force to do more there. And there's a formal dispute underway, and it's not clearing up pretty very quickly. And in fact, some people around the dispute think it may end up going to court. And having national standards is sort of seen as a way to force the federal government, in this case the military, to do more to clean up sites than, you know, having to force them to comply with state rules.
Was there any mention of creating our own standards here in Michigan, the way you heard from other states?
Not that I heard. I did hear Director Gretzer say she had a philosophical concern with states setting their own standards, and she sort of referenced it as a callback to her days as representing private industry, and she, you know, state-by-state regulation, I think she said, was a regulatory nightmare. That being said, you know, other states don't seem to maybe feel the same way or particularly care about that. New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection Commissioner Catherine McCabe stood up and announced the standards that New Jersey was prepared to set, and essentially said, look, you know, why should we wait for the EPA when we've got the science and the research done in our state to move forward with this? And our Safe Drinking Water Act essentially compels us to do that.
And did anyone from the EPA give any kind of timeline on new guidelines?
No. The Administrator Scott Pruitt announced that the process needs to begin, but the consensus was is that it could take years, a decade or more, for that to even happen, you know, for it to, from the process to begin to the point where the standards go into effect.
And now let's dive in, Garrett Ellison, to this report that you referenced, that we learned that the EPA has been sitting on this report for months now, a report that shows that the toxic PFAS pose like the danger to human health at much lower levels than what the EPA is currently telling the public. Emails released as a result of a Freedom of Information request show that, you know, the White House official warned that the release of this study would pose, and I'm quoting here, a public relations nightmare. Tell me, how was that addressed and answered at the meeting?
Well, it was sort of the elephant in the room coming into the summit, and it was addressed largely, you know, audience members said, hey, we want to see this study. When's it going to come out? The head of the ATSDR said, look, we're conferring with our federal partners. You know, that means EPA and the Defense Department. And we're trying to get everybody on the same page. And I can't tell you exactly when that report's going to be released. But it was, you know, it was not as if it was not mentioned or anything. You know, there were many people there who wanted to see it. There's been lots of desire nationwide to see that, because the emails essentially show that the ATSDR, which is the toxicology arm of the CDC, mm-hmm. is poised to recommend exposure levels that are much, much lower than what the EPA currently recommends right now.
In fact, yeah, I'm looking at your story for MLive from May 14th, and the headline, EPA's safe PFAS level is 6 times too high.
Right. I think we don't know all the details about the report, but I believe that email in which the report was called a public relations nightmare referenced one of them could be as low as 12 parts per trillion. And so that is much, much lower than the 70 parts per trillion health advisory level that the EPA currently uses, in which case, you know, that level is the thing that determines whether certain people get hooked up to alternative water supplies. In Oscoda, the Air Force won't do anything for you if you don't have PFAS in your water above that level. In the Rockford area, Wolverine Worldwide has used that level to determine, in some cases, whether you get a filtration system in your home or not. So those levels have very real-world consequences.
I'm talking with MLive's Garrett Ellison about yesterday's National PFAS Summit that the EPA held in Washington. And Garrett, we know headlines were out there yesterday. The EPA would not allow reporters from the Associated Press and CNN into the summit. Guards forcibly shoved a female reporter out of the building. What did you see?
Well, I saw the shoving. I was actually on the phone at the time. You know, it sort of happened about 10 feet away from me, and I wasn't paying too much attention to it until I started hearing yelling, and I looked over and I saw an EPA guard sort of tussling with a blonde woman and saying, you need to get out of here. And you know, she forcibly ejected her from the building. And I was with another reporter from New Jersey, and we were like, you know, what's going on? And you know, the New Jersey reporter had, while I was on the phone, had gone over and tried to give the woman the contact for somebody with the EPA press office to say, you know, if you want to get access, you need to call this woman. And so I don't know exactly what happened there, although I did see it. And, you know, when the EPA press staff came to get us and escort us to the area where the summit was happening, we said, hey, you know, this just happened. We think that was an AP reporter. And the press officers for Pruitt's office just kind of shrugged at it and said, well, yeah, they weren't invited. And so while we were inside the event, folks or media that weren't allowed to be at the event were quite upset at that. And I believe that this helped prod the EPA in some ways to reverse course and allow those media into the event for the afternoon. They had essentially just allowed, I think, 10 reporters into the event, myself included, but we weren't allowed to stay past 9:40. So really just for the first hour. And then we were asked to leave. And so later on that afternoon, I found out they were letting us back in. So I went back in, and I'm glad I was able to go back in, because that's where I was able to, you know, hear some very specific details on policy issues related to PFAS that a lot of people are asking about.
So did you hear anything that, for anyone living around the contamination sites, can they take any encouragement from what happened yesterday?
I think so. You know, in terms of having PFAS added to the list of hazardous substances, that would give the EPA authority to require certain actions related to, for instance, the Wolverine Worldwide Tannery, where right now the EPA only has authority to look at contamination other than PFAS because the federal government doesn't have enforceable PFAS standards. But Michigan does. So right now it's sort of resulted in kind of an awkward coupling between state and federal enforcement related to the tanner in Rockford. That's being called cooperative federalism, you know, and that's a big thing right now between at the EPA, you know, working with states as partners rather than this sort of parent-child relationship that, you know, it's been characterized as in the past. But essentially, yeah, I think the having PFAS added to the list of hazardous substances will go a long way towards actual cleanup of contaminated sites, potentially.
MLive's Garrett Allison, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Coming up in 10 minutes, how hackers could be using your computer to make them money.
We're now seeing a lot more instances of cryptojacking, and it is rampantly spreading through the web. So, yeah, it is definitely very concerning.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is Wednesday, and that means it's time to talk our state's history.
The United Nations considers a war stopped even more important than a war won.
If our cities go down, in my opinion, our nation will go down.
You have to think about your dream and what you want to do.
All we were trying to do was just get music for all people.
Do corporations have too much power and too little oversight? It's a question that has dominated American society pretty much since the Civil War, and it doesn't seem to be going away anytime soon. Over the decades, the political pendulum has swung back and forth between workers' rights and corporate power. This Saturday marks the 81st anniversary of the Battle of the Overpass, which many refer to as a turning point in just how people looked at the labor movement. Joining us again is the Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Welcome back, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
So let's set the table now so listeners get some context. It's 1937. It's a few years into the New Deal and just 2 years since the National Labor Relations Act became the law. Remind us again just what that law meant for workers.
So the National Labor Relations Act, or the Wagner Act, it meant that businesses had to fairly bargain with any union supported by the majority of the workers within that business. Unions weren't new, but most of them had been representing skilled trades. So after 1935, you get some unskilled trades that were able to bargain and have a voice within the industry.
And for those who may remember their Michigan history, let's just say the auto companies did not exactly like the idea of their employees having collective bargaining rights. Is that fair?
Yes, that is very fair. They did not like it. So at that time, the auto industry was very paternalistic. You get people like Henry Ford, Ari Olds, Alfred Sloan, and they see themselves as sort of the overseer and the father figure to their workers, and they do not believe their workers should have any say in things like pay or hours or conditions or overtime. So they fight unions who are trying to organize that unskilled labor force.
Tooth and nail fighting, I think, is probably fair to say.
Lots of money put behind it, too.
There you go. And Henry Ford in particular really, really wanted to keep those labor organizers away from his company. How did he go about that?
He did it a couple ways. So he starts with his $5 a day work wage. And that comes in about 1913, and he sees that as a way to keep his employees happy. If he's paying them a lot of money, then there's no reason for them to unionize and to organize. And so he starts with that. He also has a sociological department within the Ford Corporation. That group keeps tabs on its workers, especially its immigrant workers. So they make sure that they are temperate, that they are learning and speaking English. They monitor their spending habits of the workers. And so he is very much keeping track of his workers. He also finally has what's called the Ford Service Department, which sort of sounds like it's someplace you bring your car in, but it's not. It's a security force. They actually patrol the shop floor listening for union talk and will fire people on the spot.
So here we are, spring of 1937. There had been success at General Motors. There had been success at Chrysler. So the UAW, United Auto Workers, decide, let's up that organizing game at Ford. What was supposed to happen on that fateful day on May 26th, 1937?
So the UAW organizers, led by Walter Reuther and a gentleman named Richard Frankenstein, they, along with clergy and civil liberties members and members of the Women's Brigade, which is a group of women who supported union organizations, they had a permit to hand out union pamphlets on the Miller Road overpass to employees as they were leaving the River Rouge plant.
That's what was supposed to happen. What actually happened?
Harry Bennett, who is the head of Ford's service department, he and other security forces told Reuther they had to leave, and Reuther and his group refused. So Bennett's crew brutally attacked these organizers. The Women's Brigade was attacked. It was very bloody and very brutal beating in front of this crowd of union supporters, civil liberties people, and members of the press, including reporters and photographers. And there was a gentleman there named James Kilpatrick, who was a Detroit news photographer.
And James Kilpatrick's camera was busy, wasn't it, while this was all going on?
It was. He's snapping shots of the whole thing. He had actually posed Reuther and some of the other people in front of the Ford company sign. And so he had been there, you know, taking shots, action shots, posed shots. And then when all this began, his camera started going pretty nuts. He actually ended up getting some pretty good shots from it.
Do we have any sense of how many were hurt and what the toll was of this attack?
I think it was 8 people who were hurt. One gentleman apparently had his back injured badly, if not broken. Richard Frankenstein, there are photos of him, and he was beaten bloody. He was a big man, and he said it was the worst beating he'd have had in his life. So there are severe injuries that come out of this.
And then the Ford security guards realized what? Maybe beating people up in front of reporters might not have been the best idea. Did they try to cover up the beatings?
They did. Once it was done and the people were standing around, they ended up chasing people off. They were taking notebooks from the reporters. They were taking and destroying cameras from the photographers. And they actually chased James Kilpatrick to his car. He ran. And while he was in his car, he was actually able to switch out the negative plates that were in his camera for blank plates. And so when they finally caught up with him, he handed over what essentially are blank plates and hid the real negative plates in his car.
You know, you honestly couldn't script this.
No.
You really couldn't. Is that how the truth came out? Was through the Kilpatrick photos or what other avenues?
So Reuther and the people that he was with, they reported to the police and press what had happened. Bennett denies the entire thing. He says that it was union sympathizers that had started it and that his people had nothing to do with it. They were actually trying to help. And he denied the entire thing until the Kilpatrick photos were published and released in a Detroit news story about what had happened, and it became known as the Battle of the Overpass.
And so in the aftermath of these photos of James Kilpatrick, there they are in the Detroit news for everybody to see, men and women being beaten. Was Henry Ford able to keep the UAW out of his company?
No, he tried. He increased wages again to try to keep workers happy, but it was far beyond that point by then. So between the bad publicity of the photos and then Ford had to appear in front of the National Labor Relations Board to explain violations of the Wagner Act. So finally, he agreed to a contract with the UAW.
What about all of this for the labor movement on a national level? What did it do?
It really gave it a boost. You start seeing labor candidates running for office. We have a pro-labor president at that time. That helps. And we are beginning to see the light at the end of the tunnel of the Depression. So you start to see other industries unionize. You're getting labor leaders in office. And then we go into World War II, and unions are working very closely with businesses and organizations to keep production going. The idea of a strike during World War II is a pretty big threat. You need to keep that wartime production going. You start to see the increase in the growth and the power of unions at this time.
So could one rightfully argue that on that fateful day of May 26th, 1937, Ford may have won the battle but lost the war against workers' rights to collective bargaining?
Much to his chagrin, yes, he did.
The Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark. Rachel, thank you so much for sharing the story of the infamous Battle of the Overpass, which happened May 26, 1937.
Thank you for having me.
Cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin or the more than 1,500 other versions are making some people rich, and they're opening up something new. Crypto jacking, where your computer could be using its processor power, its memory, and your electricity to help make money for someone else. Pranshu Bajpai is a security researcher who's working towards his PhD at Michigan State University. His areas of interest include computer and network security, analyzing and studying malware, and privacy issues. He recently wrote a piece for TheConversation.com warning that crypto jacking is spreading across the web. Let's learn more now as we welcome Pranshu Bajpai with us now. Good to have you here.
Hey, Cynthia. Thank you for having me.
So, Pranshu, for the uninitiated, let's start right on the ground floor. Explain to us what cryptocurrency is.
Cryptocurrency is a form of digital currency. Basically, instead of minting coins or printing paper money, you're creating new units of money by a process called mining. And mining involves performing difficult, complex mathematical calculation using your computer's processing power.
So this is this mining for cryptocurrency. I think it's fuzzy to a lot of us how that makes somebody money, performing these complex mathematical calculations.
What happens is that these calculations are intentionally difficult. They're meant to securely record transactions among people using the cryptocurrency, and they provide an objective record of the order in which the transactions are conducted to avoid, for example, double spending. So the user who successfully completes these calculations gets a reward in the form of a tiny amount of that cryptocurrency, and that's where you get the money.
And it's legal, right? It's above board. It's a legal process, this mining for cryptocurrency?
Yes, it's completely legal when it is done legitimately. It is being used for malicious purposes as well, unfortunately, but the process of cryptocurrency mining itself is completely legal.
Okay, so we'll keep that in mind, and we'll be talking about the less legit purposes in a minute. But I guess as I've learned from reading your piece in The Conversation, that mining for these various cryptocurrencies is very processor intensive. So harnessing the power of other computers or networks of computers, it's very beneficial. So how does crypto jacking do that?
So basically, the attackers love to use someone else's processing power and electricity to generate them income. If you're mining a cryptocurrency, for example, Bitcoin, you have to buy specialized hardware, and it involves a lot of electricity cost, so the profits are reduced. Now, if you can get someone else's computer to do it for you, then they take all the electricity and the processor costs, and you're the one ending up with all the profits. And it has become easy with some certain new cryptocurrencies coming into the picture, such as Monero, for example, which is ideal for an average user's computer.
And your security research group at MSU, you're looking at ransomware and crypto jacking, and you call these the two biggest threats to user security in 2018.
Right. So there's reports coming out which are showing us that we're now seeing a lot more instances of crypto jacking, and it is rampantly spreading through the web. So, yeah, it is definitely very concerning.
So my computer could be crypto mining for someone, and I won't even know. How would I have any idea that this is happening?
There's some indicators. For example, you might hear noises from your coming out of your computer because your CPU's fan is trying to cool down the CPU. Like I said, the process of mining is computer processor intensive. And then, so that those are signs. And then you might see your computer slowing down and getting sluggish. And if you look at, for example, your task manager and your CPU usage, you'll see that your CPU is being used to 100%. And that is a good indicator that a mining activity might be going on.
So here we are talking. We've certainly heard a lot about this malicious software or malware, and this cryptojacking falls under that term. Where are the cryptojackers most commonly embedding their scripts or their lines of code? How are they getting into our computers?
What happens is when you visit a particular website, the website's owner or maybe an attacker would embed four lines of code, and it's called a JavaScript code, into their website, which executes in your browser when you open the website. So when you're browsing the website, everything looks normal, but transparently in the background, it starts a process on your computer that is using your CPU to mine cryptocurrency for them. Now, you will see this a lot on websites that are already involved in some sort of other malicious activities, and these websites are known for delivering malware to users.
Give us an idea so we can know what to watch for when you say these kinds of websites. Pornography, music sharing, what are we talking about?
Right. So in our preliminary web crawl, we saw that a lot of pornography websites are involved in this, some IT websites as well, some games and entertainment websites. Streaming media websites, something like Netflix and YouTube is legitimate and will not mine on your computer. But if you go to some shady website that is hosting probably illegal pirated content, it is very likely that it will try to mine in the background, because you stay on that page for a long period of time while you're watching the movie, and in the background, the website will use your computer's processing power to make them money.
And I have to ask you while we're on this, Pranshu, what about, for example, when you're on Facebook and you see these goofy quizzes? I actually lifted a couple titles from the wall of a Facebook friend that I've actually muted because she's constantly sharing the quizzes. I'm suspicious. For example, which country is your soul actually from? Or would your loved one in heaven be proud of you, to get you to click on and do that? Are those to be avoided?
Right. Any kind of sometimes there's a lot of social media malware going around, which basically will try to get you to click on something and end up on a website that you don't want to be on. And there are scripts that will help spread it once you click it. So if you have clicked it, then, you know, it will spread on your wall. From there, your friends pick it up and so on. So that is definitely part of the problem.
So somehow, I don't think you, as someone who's a security researcher, would be clicking on the quiz, which country is your soul actually from?
No, I don't usually click on things like that. If we have to do it for research purposes, we have virtual environments where we do it to try to analyze the threat to understand what it is doing exactly. But in normal scenarios, you better not download and execute it, because it's either going to be a ransomware threat or lately it's cryptojacking is popular, so it's going to be a cryptojacking malware. They love to have names like invoice.exe or resume.exe. That one is very popular. For some reason, people love to open resumes or invoices. I don't know why.
How about large institutions, whether companies or universities? How vulnerable are they to cryptojacking?
The problem of cryptojacking is especially concerning in large organizations, because your users, for example, might inadvertently end up on a website that's mining. A lot of your users across your organization are ending up on the wrong websites, means that you're losing a lot of your processing power, your computers are getting slower on a larger scale, and you're losing electricity because a lot of these computers are all mining. Many times users will end up inadvertently on these websites, but a few times, because the process is so easy, that all you have to do is go on a page that lets you mine, That means that sometimes your employees might use the computers allocated to them and go on one of these websites to mine currency that will then be credited to their account. So the organization loses the electricity, but the employees who are an internal threat might end up making some money out of it, or inadvertently the employees might end up going on a website that makes money for attackers elsewhere.
What can users, websites, institutions do to protect against cryptojacking?
It is essential that you regularly update your computers. That helps patch a lot of critical security vulnerabilities in time. And ransomware and cryptojacking developers love to exploit those threats. We've seen a lot of cases where people are enabling remote services. For example, remote desktop protocol, which is used to remotely connect to a computer, and they use poor passwords to secure them. So if you've got remote services enabled, secure them with strong passwords. Last but not the least, an updated antivirus helps block not just common viruses, but cryptojacking malware, ransomware, and it even helps block browser-based threats in some cases. So that takes care of browser-based cryptojacking as well.
Getting us on guard. Pranshu Bajpai is a security researcher and PhD candidate at Michigan State University. You'll find his piece on cryptojacking spreading across the web, co-authored with MSU Associate Professor Richard Enbody, by going to theconversation.com. Pranshu, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we'll hear what happened when a Michigan mom turned to the mental health system seeking help for her son.
And someone finally came out, a social worker, I believe, and we went back and talked in a room, and she wanted to know what was going on. And I said, you know, my son is going to hurt someone if he's not hospitalized right away.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Whenever there's a mass shooting at a school, we hear talk about mental health, the need to identify troubled kids and get them into the mental health system before something terrible happens. Well, today we're going to hear from a Michigan mother who tried to do that. She tried to find help for her son, but there was little help to be found, and now her son is in prison for stabbing someone. When Paula Reeves first noticed that her son David was having problems as a young child, she says she sought professional help immediately.
Ultimately, at a young age, he was diagnosed with an emerging bipolar 1 disorder, which is very serious. And he was treated with Trileptal, and that he did respond to that medication very well. And it calmed him down significantly. He was able to focus, but then he would stop taking it.
Which is such a common theme that you hear.
It is.
You start feeling better, so you stop taking the meds.
That's right.
And this, did this pretty much continue through high school?
It did continue, and I wasn't really sure what was going on. There was a time when he was about 12 years old when I would come home and I noticed that there were, inside of the closet on the walls, there would be these holes, and there was no one there with me at that time, so it was as though he had taken a hammer and punched a hole into the wall. And I looked back on that. I didn't know what that meant at the time, but I looked back on that, and I think he was having probably some form of delusions that I wasn't aware of.
What was it like navigating the mental health care system?
What mental health care system? We have a mockery of a system. I think that's probably true in all the states, but most of my experience has been here in the state of Michigan. And Michigan, when I've tried to get help for him, it's very sparse, and it's very difficult to get. And it isn't long enough on an outpatient basis, and it isn't long enough on a residential basis to stabilize a person. And there's very few places someone like my son could actually find reprieve and also get supports in place and have appropriate supports in place for someone like him.
As we talk now, your son is in prison. He got a sentence of 15 to 40 years in 2017. Tell us what happened.
He was sentenced because in 2015, he started to threaten me. And before that, he was making threats also to his father. He was beginning to frighten me. He was at a stage where he was just not doing well at all. And he had been threatening to shoot me in the head with a gun. At that point, I left the home and I pulled down the petitions for involuntary commitment for the state of Michigan. And I had, by the way, asked David previously and said to him, you know, would you please go see somebody? Would you go in and see if we can get your medication checked? Would you go voluntarily? And he wasn't going to do it. Absolutely not.
The ducks were lining up in a row, in a sense. He'd refused help.
That's right.
He was threatening you, threatening to shoot you in the head.
That's right.
So you pulled down the petition for involuntary commitment.
Yes.
What happened?
I filled it out. And this one was an unusually long, detailed petition. It was 5 pages. Normally, I try to put as little as possible into them. But it was so serious that I wrote some of the threats that he was making to me. And then I had his father forward the texts that my son was making to his father, where he said he was going to, quote, slaughter his father. And he thought his father and I were Nazis, and he wanted us to apologize for our wrongdoings. Clearly psychotic behavior. So I went to the court, filed a petition. It was granted. My son was picked up by a local police officer, and he was had a security check. And then he was driven by the officer, who I knew and who also knew my son, to a place called Common Ground in Pontiac. And that is a facility where my son was to be evaluated.
All right. So this is like step one. What happened there?
I went over to the facility after I knew that he was dropped off. And someone finally came out, a social worker, I believe, and we went back and talked in a room, and she wanted to know what was going on. And I said, you know, my son is going to hurt someone if he's not hospitalized right away and medicated. Then I got a call from a police officer, and the police officer was asking me some questions about my son. And then the facility had told me that my son had been arrested for stabbing somebody. My son had either located a 3-inch knife, a folding knife, inside the facility, or he had brought it in. No one knows for sure.
And so that's what landed him in prison with the sentence for stabbing this worker.
Yes, it was a janitor that he stabbed, and she was taken out in a stretcher. She did survive, thankfully, but he was charged with intent to commit murder and possession of a weapon, in this case, a 3-inch knife.
And how long was he in jail awaiting the outcome of this case?
Over 2 years.
And what was it like there for him? Was he getting any kind of treatment, any kind of help that you could see?
He sat in jail for 2 years, almost always without treatment. So what happened during that period of time was he was moved eventually from the mental health wing to a more general population. And within, I think, 24, 48 hours, someone had split my son's head open. And then my son, because he was floridly psychotic, started making phone calls to the district judges and started saying ethnically inappropriate things and trying to threaten them and intimidate them and so on. And he eventually picked up an ethnic intimidation charge in his state of psychosis. And then he was put into isolation, which means in the jail, from his description, it was a cement block room about the size of a small bathroom. And he had nothing to do all day. He was pacing back and forth, and he became more and more psychotic and more out of control.
Could you visit him?
No. Eventually, they cut off my visits also.
And so he gets this sentence under this plea of guilty but mentally ill. What did that mean for David?
That plea of guilty but mentally ill meant that my son could formulate intent to harm someone, and he was found responsible for his crime, therefore, but mentally ill. That plea sent him to prison.
What is his life in prison like now?
It isn't good. He's despondent. Again, I can't see where he is, but I had him describe it to me because I wanted to be clear about where he was. It's a cement block room, and he's in what they call a residential area. It's with other prisoners who have serious mental health disorders like him. And he is on a medication which has allowed him to function, because in prison versus in jail, if you're found guilty but mentally ill, they mandatorily have to give you the medications. He can't refuse it. But he just feels hopeless. He feels that he's never going to get out.
How would you like to have seen things play out for your son, given that he nearly killed someone?
My son should have been found clearly not guilty by reason of insanity. And what the public does not know about that particular verdict is that you go into a secure environment at the Forensic Center where there are security guards. Some of the security guards also work in the prison across the street, which is Huron Valley. So they're very well trained. But they're also very well trained in psychiatric disorders. They understand them. They've had training on site. And the doctors are incredibly well trained, and they have available to them much better medications, and the programs are thorough, and they're geared towards humanely treating but also securing the person that's in the forensic center. So it's not really, calling it not guilty really is probably a misnomer, but the jury again doesn't know if they hear those facts. They hear not guilty and they think, well, they're going to get out, but that isn't at all what happens. They end up sometimes staying much longer at the forensic center than even in a prison setting.
Whenever there is another story in the news about a mass shooter, immediately we hear some of our elected officials calling them crazy and saying we need to look at dealing with mental health issues, I'm doing air quotes here, and take guns away from people who are mentally ill. How does that make you feel when you hear that response?
It makes me feel like we have absolute idiots at the helm of the ship. This is the 21st century. We have science proving that what we call mental is actually a physical disorder of the brain. We used to make fun of people with developmental disabilities. We made fun of people that showed symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. We would call them crazy, mentally ill, so on and so forth. Any kind of the 16 or so different types of dementia, we did the same thing. We thought they were, quote, insane at the end of their lives. Nancy Reagan put the face of Alzheimer's in the public with Ronald Reagan, and we now don't hear those kind of name calling. Forrest Gump, the movie, put the face of developmental disabilities in the face of the public. We still call people who have schizophrenia, even though there's so much evidence to the contrary, crazy, insane, monsters. How do we get laws in place and funding for mental health services if we don't have our top leaders, our policymakers, understanding and educated about these issues?
Paula Reeves, we want to thank you so much for sharing your story and your son's story with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
We turn now to Michael Perlin. He's professor emeritus at New York Law School, the founding director of the International Mental Disability Law Reform Project, and he's co-founder of Mental Disability Law and Policy Associates. Professor Michael Perlin, welcome to the program.
And I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
So let's break down, first of all, the differences between guilty but mentally ill and not guilty by reason of insanity. Now, what does it mean when you're found not guilty by reason of insanity?
When you're found not guilty by reason of insanity means you committed the act that would be a crime if you were, quote, responsible for it. In most jurisdictions, it means you are not able to know, quote, right from wrong. And that definition has been with us for 170 years.
Let's go now to how it differs from being found guilty but mentally ill.
If you're found guilty but mentally ill, what that means is you are guilty, you were mentally ill, and you did not meet the statutory standard in that jurisdiction, and you were not, quote, legally insane of the crime in question.
Okay. And this guilty but mentally ill verdict actually does have roots in Michigan. How did it come about?
That's correct. In 1975 in Michigan, there was a 1974 decision called People versus McQuillan. And McQuillan said the mere fact that somebody was found not guilty by reason of insanity did not mean in and of itself he had to be committed to a maximum security facility. And one of the people after the McQuillan case was decided who had been found NGRI, who was released, was charged with committing another crime. So as a reflection of legislative dissatisfaction with and the public outcry over the McQuillan decision, the legislature created the verdict to quote, and I'm quoting directly from a case called Seafeld, a 1980 Michigan case, to protect the public from violence inflicted by persons with mental ailments who slip through the cracks of the criminal justice system. And what's interesting is three states adopted GBMI after Michigan within the next year or two, but it wasn't until the verdict in the John Hinckley case. Hinckley's the guy who was found NGRI, not guilty by reason of insanity, for shooting President Reagan, mm-hmm. that other states adopted the GBMI verdict. I'm on record as saying I think the verdict is a fraud. And I think it's especially pernicious because you build false hopes. It misleads offenders. It misleads the public. It misleads courts. It misleads defense attorneys who believe that GBMI defendants are accorded some kind of special post-conviction treatment. They are not.
And what do the statistics show, Michael, in terms of length of sentences compared to someone who's just found guilty versus guilty but mentally ill?
Well, we know this. We know any time mental illness is raised in a case, whether you are successful or not, you spend more time locked up than if it is not raised.
And so why do we have this?
We have it so legislators think they're doing something. Legislators thought this was going to reduce the, quote, huge number of jury verdicts, which is totally dead wrong. Here are the statistics. In 1/120th of 1% of all cases, is there a successful contested insanity defense?
Michael, in your view, what is the better way, the best way that we should be handling people who, you know, have mental illness, have committed some offense, they're caught up in the criminal justice system? What should we be doing better?
I have two separate sets of answers to that. One set is those people who are, quote, caught up in the criminal justice system, but who never should have been arrested in the first place. There are cases in which a person is charged with something like failure to give a good account of himself, avoiding arrest, not responding to an officer's inquiry. And they wind up going on this shuttle system from street to jail to hospital to street, repeat cycle. These people should not go into the criminal justice system at all in the first place. These people should be diverted to the mental health system. And we know that when jurisdictions follow what is called the Memphis model, since that's the first place it happened, and police are trained in how to deal with people presenting like this, that arrest rates go down and those problems are really significantly alleviated. On the other hand, a very, very small percentage of people who commit violent crimes have serious mental illness. It is statistically almost insignificant. But again, we hear about it. We know about it. It bothers us. I mean, I remember back in law school when we read about the insanity defense, I remember reading a philosopher's writing, and this has stuck with me. I graduated law school a long time ago, saying one of the reasons why we, the public, doesn't like the insanity defense is that we are good boys and girls. But sometimes the fact that some people seem to be, quote, getting away with it, end quote, really, really riles us because we're good and they're not. They kind of gave in to base impulses, not for a minute understanding that people act in many ways because their mind is working very different ways than yours and mine are, that it's not kind of an optional choice. I believe those people, to answer your question, should be given authentic mental health treatment. I don't know whether authentic mental health treatment can actually be given in prison. Can it be given in hospitals? I think, yeah, to some extent it can be for people who present as you just described. But I think they need to be completely rethought. And I think there's lots of very, very smart people out there, people who study these things, who could come up with blueprints for what would work, what would a maximum security hospital for people who have committed serious dangerous acts, what would it look like? But they're not going to go anywhere. It's not going to fly because legislators are afraid of being, you guessed it, soft on crime. And this simply will not happen. So we're stuck with what we have. This sounds very nihilistic, I'm afraid, but I guess to some extent it is.
Michael Perlin, New York Law School, also the founding director of the International Mental Disability Law Reform Project and co-founder of Mental Disability Law and Policy Associates. Thank you so much for being with us today, Michael. It was great to talk with you.
It was great talking to you.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Sarah Leeson, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.